Hi, and welcome to Legal Options and Ethical Obligations for Clients with Mental Health Impairments. I'm Carolyn Reinach-Wolf. I'm an executive partner at Abrams Fensterman, and I'm also director of the firm's mental health law practice, which I started over 30 years ago, seeing a need to help families and institutions navigate through the mental health legal system and the clinical system. I'm the first attorney in the country with a family-focused practice dedicated to serving individuals and families who struggle with serious mental illness, alcohol and drug addiction, and other related mental health challenges. I'm supported by a team of expert clinicians and departmental attorneys, and I concentrate in guiding families through these complex landscapes of legal issues that impact loved ones. I also represent many hospitals, hospital systems, mental health care systems, and higher education institutions. I'm a regular contributor to Psychology Today. I write a blog for them, and I've been profiled by the New York Times in a 2013 story entitled A Guide in the Darkness, which ran on the front page of the Sunday edition of the Metro section of the New York Times. I'm a past president of the National Behavioral Intervention Team Association and the Association for Healthcare Risk Management of New York. I hold a JD from the Maurice Dean School of Law at Hofstra University, an MS in Health Services Administration from the Harvard School of Public Health, and an MBA in Management from the Hofstra University School of Business. I'm admitted to practice in New York State, federal courts, as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. I've recently been selected as an honoree of the City and State of New York's 2024 Above and Beyond Women and of the Long Island Business News for my work in the mental health space and the overall healthcare system. So let's begin. As an overview, mental illnesses are common in the United States, with estimated that more than 1 in 5 U.S. adults live with a mental illness. And that source is the National Institute of Mental Health. As lawyers, we have to keep this statistic in mind when meeting with clients and assessing their overall capacity. Traditional legal responses need to be viewed and approached through an appropriate mental health lens. Lawyers who'll be taking this webinar will develop the tools needed to recognize mental health impairments in clients, understand their legal obligations in those situations as attorneys, and hopefully will become aware of the legal options available to appropriately respond and protect their clients. An awareness of the legal remedies and tools that are available and the ability to assess their appropriateness on a case-by-case basis will enable lawyers to assist clients in the mental health population and assist clients whose loved ones suffer from mental health impairments. By exploring the traditional legal resources and how they can be adapted for an individual suffering from a mental illness, hopefully this webinar will prepare you to navigate the ethical rules and obtain optimal outcomes for your clients. So most attorneys are not familiar with or have reason to be familiar with individuals or their clients who suffer from mental health impairments. This webinar is designed to assist in making an assessment and in determining what course of action a lawyer needs to have and do and be familiar with in order to best serve their clients or those who surround their clients, such as their families, neighbors, friends, loved ones. So what are the first steps in a client assessment? Whether it's recognized or not, each meeting with a client or potential client includes a capacity assessment by the attorney. We don't have to go back and get PhDs in psychology or MDs in psychiatry in order to make these types of assessments. We don't have to become experts in mental health clinical issues. But attorneys do have an ethical obligation to assess capacity in order to execute documents, know that the client can sign a retainer agreement, work with families of those with a mental illness, and provide the legal services that are necessary and required when clients come to us for assistance. The model rules of professional conduct include ethical guidelines for capacity assessments and the appropriate responses to those. The following red flags that I'm going to outline for you are signals that a client may be suffering from diminished capacity or some sort of mental health impairment. When red flags are present, attorneys must follow ethical rules in their representation of that client or of those who surround the individual. It's very important to know what the legal criteria are for executing documents or bringing legal cases. And we're going to talk about documents such as wills, trusts, guardianship, conservatorship, all of those areas of law that directly impact the issue of capacity and whether a client has the requisite capacity to execute documents, follow up on a legal case with the assistance of their attorney, and so on. It's also important to keep in mind that often clients come to us who are not the individuals with a mental health impairment, but are seeking our guidance as attorneys in order to determine what needs to be done on behalf of the individual who suffers from a mental health impairment. So it's very important to take a solid and full history, not only of the client in front of us, but those who surround them, whether they're family members or neighbors, depending on exactly why they've come to us and what they're asking us to do for them in terms of retained services. So what are some of the mental health red flags? One is memory loss, which is an inability to recall information discussed in prior meetings or communications. Someone comes to you, wants to execute a will, and returns to your office to execute that will, and all of a sudden they say, why am I here? What is this piece of paper? I don't remember doing this. It's pretty obvious when somebody has impaired memory. If we take the time to look for the signs and have these conversations, there are many situations where someone initially can override the impairment that they have. And it's important to speak to a client or to speak to a family of a loved one and assess with more time involved in order to determine whether somebody suffers from a memory loss. So sometimes you have to keep someone talking for a little more than just a minute or two. Ask them about their family. Ask them about why they're here. Ask them if they recall why they were here the last time. Ask them about, do they know what day it is or where they are, and so on and so forth. Again, we don't have to become experts in mental health assessments, as psychologists and psychiatrists have to do, but we are obligated under the ethical rules to at least assess red flags. So memory loss, as I've said, is one of them. Communication problems, difficulty staying on topic, repetitive. I'm here why, I don't understand why I'm here. I didn't ask to execute a will, but maybe I did, and so on and so forth. Staying on topic, you're here to execute a will, and they start to talk about the weather or the vacation they took 2 weeks ago or issues with a family member and so on. So again, attorneys certainly are skilled in addressing communication problems and picking up on this particular red flag. Lack of mental flexibility, a refusal to consider alternatives or discuss the lawyer's recommendation. Client doesn't have to agree, they don't have to consider the alternatives, but they do have to at least acknowledge that, thank you, you've given me another option here, but I choose not to execute that option. or I know that's your recommendation, but I really want to do this. This lack of flexibility, this extreme rigidity is something that at least we should pick up on and follow up on. It may just be a personality issue. It may just be someone who doesn't consider alternatives or doesn't like to follow recommendations. But again, if we have long enough conversations and take some extra time to explore this, we may be able to notice that this is more of a red flag or an issue of concern regarding capacity than just somebody who is a rigid person or thinks they're always right or doesn't have the ability to consider alternatives. Another red flag is someone who's unable to understand or acknowledge multiple options or viewpoints. Again, it's a rigidity that's more than just a personality quirk or just someone who's used to being in control. So we want to explore, sometimes in greater detail, can you understand or acknowledge other options or viewpoints? Again, the person doesn't have to agree with it, doesn't have to like it, doesn't have to ultimately go along with it, but extreme rigidity may be a red flag for the attorney to consider. Another possible red flag is disorientation relative to time, space, or location. Why am I here again? Was I here last week? Is this a law office? It seems like this is winter time, yet I'm dressed in a sundress. Whatever it might be, where you can see clearly that somebody has a disorientation to space, time, or location. Emotional inappropriateness can also be a mental health red flag. Wide range of emotion, inappropriate laughter or crying. It's called in the clinical world mood lability. You go from very high to very low. You're laughing, the client is laughing at one moment and then crying in the next. Again, it may be appropriate to what you're discussing or it may not be. But you want to pay attention to that sudden change or wide range of emotions and take that into consideration when you're assessing a client's capacity to execute documents or participate in a lawsuit. There are also behavioral signs that we need to consider. Delusions, which are a belief that are unlikely to be true. So there is the longstanding joke about how do you know the FBI really isn't following you? Well, a delusion is different from what is a possibility in real life. It takes over someone's life. A person perseverates on it. They talk about it over and over and over. It's out of context with the type of life they're leading, their job, the reason for being in your office, and so on. And in many cases, we as attorneys can know the difference between a delusion and whether it's just a life circumstance. Again, these are beliefs that are unlikely to be true in the real world and so on. Poor grooming or hygiene, not just someone who doesn't dress to the hilt, but somebody who appears disheveled, looks like they haven't showered in a very long time. Unkempt, as it's called, very dirty clothes, very dirty physical appearance. You know, poor grooming and poor hygiene can be a symptom of a mental health red flag. Again, we need to keep that in context of who the person is, why they're in our office, what their background is, and so on. Another possible mental health red flag would be inappropriate behavior in the courtroom or in the lawyer's office. Screaming out, shouting out, questioning when it's not appropriate, addressing the judge in an inappropriate way, interfering with a conversation that the attorneys might be having. Again, this is one of those you know it when you see it. And can the person contain themselves when it's appropriate or inappropriate? Can they sit quietly next to you in a courtroom? Can they participate in a deposition without shouting out, interrupting, bringing up issues that are not in the that are not part of the conversation, and so on? It's also possibly an inability to follow up with the lawyer's requests for information and documentation. Sometimes clients forget what we've asked them to bring to the office or to email to us. That certainly can happen, but when it happens over and over and over, and the client or the family member is saying, "What is it you wanted again? What is it you need from us?" Over and over and over, that can sometimes cause a lawyer to be concerned about capacity and the ability to follow up with requests for information, excuse me, and documentation. Okay, so now you've spotted the red flag that we've talked about. What do you do next? So the ABA has model rules of professional conduct that govern what we are discussing today. Rule 1.4, communications, states in subsection B, a lawyer shall explain a matter to the extent reasonably necessary to permit the client to make informed decisions regarding the representation. A lawyer needs to explain the matter to the client. Again, the wording is reasonably necessary. It doesn't have to be a law school lecture. It doesn't have to be in great detail, legal ease or medical ease, but it says reasonably necessary, and again, it's the reasonable person standard, to permit the client to make an informed decision regarding the representation. What information do you have to give a client or give a family member of a client to be informed enough to understand what the representation is, what the subject matter of a potential lawsuit is, what your legal concentration might be, and so on. So it's very important to pay attention to the wording of these model rules. ABA Model Rule 1.4, Comment Subsection 5 says, the client should have sufficient information to participate intelligently in decisions concerning the objectives of the representation and the means by which they are to be pursued, to the extent the client is willing and able to do so. Adequacy of communication depends in part on the kind of advice or assistance that is involved. So again, it says sufficient information. What specific information relative to the reason the client has come to you as an attorney is necessary in order for them to, the wording says, intelligently make decisions concerning the objectives of the representation? Again, we need to look at a person's level of education, level of experience, age, and so on. But we also need to look for
Esquire CLE's first verification code is TON, T-O-N, all lowercase, TON. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TON, T-O-N, all lowercase, TON. Please take a moment and write this down.
To see if there's something in the way of red flags, as we've talked about, that might interfere with the objectives of the representation that you as an attorney are seeking. And it, wording goes on to talk about the extent the client is willing and able to do so. And again, you need to separate personality quirks from somebody who is truly impaired and not just willing and able, but unwilling and unable due to things other than related to a rigid personality or some preconceived notions and so on. The adequacy of communication will depend on the type of advice or assistance that's involved. How complicated is the lawsuit? How straightforward is it? Is it something that the client has been involved in previously? Should they have more of an understanding than they appear to have, given that they've been in your office multiple times? So they've been to multiple lawyers and it's been explained to them multiple times. So again, it's important to understand the wording of these model rules and follow up appropriately. ABA Model Rule 1.4, Comment Subsection 6 says, ordinarily, the information to be provided is that appropriate for a client who is a comprehending and responsible adult. However, fully informing the client according to the standard may be impractical. For example, where the client is a child or suffers from some sort of diminished capacity. And when you talk about diminished capacity, you need to ascertain whether it's a major issue in the type of services you're being asked to provide, or is it just diminished in some way? Sometimes people are forgetful, or there's one particular point they missed when you discussed it with them previously. So you need to assess diminished capacity from lack of capacity. Do they truly have no understanding of what you're talking about, no understanding of why they're there seeking your advice, and so on? And the ABA model rule also refers back to rule 1.14, which we're going to discuss now. So rule 1.14, client with diminished capacity. When a client's capacity to make adequately considered decisions in connection with a representation is diminished, whether because of minority, mental impairment, or for some other reason, the lawyer shall, as far as reasonably possible, and there again, we have the reasonableness standard, maintain a normal client-lawyer relationship with the client. So we want to look at what are the particular circumstances of this client before us. Childhood, obviously, is easy to ascertain. You know that, hopefully, the age of the child, and you can assess the maturity of a child. Certainly, a five-year-old is different than speaking to a 15-year-old. And so that assessment needs to be done in order to reasonably ascertain whether even a minor can understand the type of representation you may be offering them, the circumstances of the particular lawsuit or legal proceeding. We see this a lot in child custody cases and so on. Whether it's by virtue of age, but they can understand things if we put them in simpler terms, or mental impairment, where there's really no ability to take in the information, process the information, have the cognitive ability to understand the information, and work with us in an attorney-client relationship. Again, pay attention to the wording where representation is diminished, as opposed to non-existent, and reasonably possible. ABA Model Rules 1.14, Comment Subsection 3 says, a client may wish to have family members or other persons participate in discussions with the lawyer. When necessary to assist in the representation, the presence of such persons generally does not affect the applicability of the attorney-client evidentiary privilege. Nevertheless, the lawyer must keep the client's interests foremost and, except for protective action authorized under paragraph B, must look to the client and not family members to make decisions on the client's behalf. Again, it means communication, taking in information. If it's an elderly client and they say, I'd like my adult son or daughter or brother-in-law or whomever it might be to sit in on this because they have better memory than I do. They take notes. They understand this area of the law. I want them to assist me in working with you as the attorney. That's okay. And you want to document in your records that it's with the understanding that there is a third person as part of the discussion in this attorney-client relationship, and that the individual has asked for this assistance or is consenting to have a third party as part of the discussion. Again, it means assessing a person's ability to take in information, understand that information, process that information in order for the attorney to achieve the goal of giving services and providing advice that's pertinent to the case before them. And as the model rule says, the attorney must look to the client and not the family members to make decisions on the client's behalf. If you have concerns that there's a conflict of interest or the client is uneasy or no longer wishes for that third party to be part of the discussion, or there are very personal issues that are now being discussed after the beginning part of a discussion, you may want to ask that third party to leave. Again, you need to assess each situation individually as it comes up. So how does this all work in actual practice? Well, for example, in New York, there's a case called Matter of SB. It's the Supreme Court of New York City in 2019. The New York's guardianship statute requires that an attorney for an AIP or alleged incapacitated person ensure that the point of view of the AIP is presented to the court. Guardianship is what it's called in New York. In your individual states, it may be called conservatorship. It's really the same idea, but as we all know, guardianship, conservatorship is state law. So we need to look to what our individual state law is in this area and follow the guidelines and the requirements as appropriate. In New York, the New York Rules of Professional Conduct 1.14 regarding representation of individuals with diminished capacity, quote, does not provide specific guidance to an attorney for an AIP who is unclear whether his or her client has the capacity to direct the defense of the litigation or whether the counsel should rely on decisions to be made by the appointed agent under the AIP's power of attorney, for example, unquote. So we need to look further when representing clients who have some sort of diminished capacity, whether it's a medical reason, whether it's an issue of dementia, Alzheimer's, whether it's serious mental illness, whether it's impaired by drugs or alcohol, whether it's someone on the autism spectrum who may have abilities in one area but not another. And we need to tease apart exactly what that mental health challenge might be and how pertinent it is to what we want to accomplish for the client. To the extent an AIP has communicated a position relative to the request for the appointment of a guardian, that counsel can make decisions and pursue a litigation strategy that honor the AIP's perspective. And the law says that a person is deemed to have capacity unless shown otherwise. So again, we don't need to become experts in mental health or capacity evaluations, but going back to the red flags that we've been discussing, should any of these arise, it's important to take a step back, question whether the person really understands what it is before the lawyer and the client, and maybe inquire further as to how much they're able to understand or not understand. Capacity can wax and wane. Capacity is also subject specific. So somebody doesn't have to be knowledgeable about how to build a spaceship, but needs to be at least understanding of wanting to execute a will or wanting to appoint somebody as an agent under a healthcare proxy or a power of attorney. Understand the need for someone to help and assist them in their daily life and may consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian. So again, you want to be very specific in doing your legal assessment pursuant to capacity in specifically understanding what the person can take in and process and their cognitive abilities relative to that subject matter. What if the client is unable to express or consistently state a legal position? Or a client comes to you with a concern about a loved one in need of mental health services. And we see this very much in the area of trust and estates law, often landlord-tenant law, matrimonial law, really any other area of the law that requires a client, which is most areas of the law, to understand why they're seeking legal advice, what the legal challenges might be. In my mental health law practice, we co-counsel cases all the time with other legal experts or other legal areas of concentration in order to call out what are the mental health issues separate and apart from that particular legal area of concentration. So it may be a custody case or a matrimonial case, and the lawyer has concerns about someone's mental status to really understand why they're in a matrimonial lawyer's office seeking a divorce or a separation, why there are custody issues, whether it's challenges for the parents or the particular child, and so on. And so we bring our area of concentration in mental health law to work and support those attorneys who don't have the same experience in addressing the mental health issues that might arise. The ABA Model Rules of Professional Conduct, well, Model Rule 1.14, Client with Diminished Capacity, says in subsection B, when the lawyer reasonably believes the client has diminished capacity, is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm unless action is taken and cannot adequately act in the client's own interest, the lawyer may take, and again, it may take, reasonably necessary protective action, including consulting with individuals or entities that have the ability to take action to protect the client, and in appropriate cases, seeking the appointment of a guardian ad litem, a conservator, or a full-blown guardian. So again, we want to pay attention to the wording of these model rules. If the attorney finds they cannot adequately act in the client's own interest, the client can't focus, can't understand, keeps diverting into other areas, separate and apart from the discussion in front of them or the lawsuit that they're supposed to be addressing. The lawyer has to take reasonably necessary protective action, and by has to, I mean may take. That's the wording of the law. Again, each case is very individual and different on its face, different circumstances, different family situations, different age, different experience. And we need to take all of this into consideration when we're deciding whether we need to bring in other areas of expertise, other individuals. There are times where we will send someone in my practice to a psychiatric evaluation so that we know what we're dealing with. Is the person really impaired? Do they really have a lack of capacity? When it's unclear or we're not sure, in order to ascertain what it is we're dealing with. Is it a substance use disorder issue? Is it serious mental illness? Is it a traumatic brain injury that is resulting in mental health challenges? Is it someone who has a medical condition that can result in mental health challenges? So often we, with the consent of the client or someone legally authorized to consent, we will bring in under the attorney-client umbrella an expert who understands and appreciates the capacity challenges, the need for protective action if someone is truly unable to participate in their legal matter. When assessing the legal options available as both the attorney for a client with diminished capacity or the advocate on behalf of a family seeking assistance for their loved one, we encourage attorneys to consider costs, it can be very costly to bring in a medical expert or a psychiatric expert or a social work expert. So cost is very often an issue, and you will need to determine that as the attorney as you talk to the clients about this. And also, the potential trauma to the client. You're challenging someone's mental capacity or mental ability to understand and appreciate either their limitations or their signs and symptoms that may result from an impaired mental health state. So we want to consider potential trauma to the client, or we may want to take a longer and more directed approach in discussing this with the client. We're not saying you're a bad person. We're not saying that you're crazy, as some people term it. We're not saying that you're less of a person. We just want to understand what the diminished capacity is about, whether as the legal, ethical challenges that we have as lawyers are being met, and whether you as a client can participate in your own best interest. So these are all parts of conversations we want to have with a client. You want to also be aware of any law that requires the lawyer to advocate the least restrictive action on behalf of the client. So in most areas of law, it's the least restrictive alternative, narrowly tailored to meet the needs of the client, and you want to make sure that you're aware of what that is in a particular area of the law. All of this keeping in mind the requirements of confidentiality. Model Rule 1.14, comments 5-7, talk directly about all of these types of issues. Now, ABA Model Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.14, continued client with diminished capacity, subsection C, talks about information relating to the representation of a client with diminished capacity, which is protected by Rule 1.6. When taking protective action pursuant to paragraph subsection B, the lawyer is impliedly authorized under Rule 1.6, subsection A, to reveal information about the client, but only to the extent reasonably necessary to protect the client's interest. So again, least restrictive alternative, narrowly tailored. If you need to seek outside advice about a client, you want to keep it as narrow as possible. You don't have to share the entirety of a lawsuit or of conversations that you had, but I recommend that you keep it specific, again, to the capacity issue. Memory, ability to know, to be oriented to time, person, and place. Strange things that the client may be saying to you that appear to be overly paranoid or delusional or not in reality. That is, I believe, what is necessary to the extent reasonably necessary to protect the client's interests. We really need to take a step back and ascertain this as we go forward when we're working with clients who may or may not have diminished capacity. ABA Model Rule 1.14, comment subsection 8 says, disclosure of the client's diminished capacity could adversely affect the client's interests. For example, raising the question of diminished capacity could, in some circumstances, lead to proceedings for an involuntary commitment. Information relating to the representation is protected by Rule 1.6. Therefore, unless authorized to do so, the lawyer may not disclose such information. And often it's very hard to work that line between asking for additional assistance or input when we have concerns about a client with diminished capacity and compromising their legal matter. And again, every case is different on its face. We have to ascertain and make these decisions on a case-by-case basis. If it's to the extreme where you believe somebody is truly a danger to themselves or others, hospitalization and emergency intervention may be necessary. Again, you want to try and ascertain the level of discomfort, the level of lack of capacity, and be guided by what your instincts tell you and your experience tells you as to what assistance to get for a particular client or what actions to take. As a former hospital risk manager, I am very big on the issue of documentation. So when you're working in this area of capacity and taking certain actions other than the usual actions that you'll take as an attorney, it's very, very important to properly document the notes in your own records pursuant to a person's capacity or lack thereof or any actions that you might be taking. And again, as we teach residents when we lecture to them in hospitals, trust your gut. It's and mental health experts will support that idea all the time. If your gut tells you something is not right, or it's out of the norm, or it's strange, or it's questionable, trust your gut. Your gut will, more times than not, be correct. Take a moment. Take a breath, take a few minutes to stop and think about and consider where you are in that area of capacity with a client and what appropriate actions may be necessary. Sometimes we have to wait till the client leaves to get the advice that we need and the counsel we need to make these decisions, but it's always better to take a step back if we have the ability to do that. Ascertain where we are in this area of capacity or lack thereof.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is HOT, H-O-T, all lowercase, HOT. Please take a moment to write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is HOT, H-O-T, all lowercase, HOT. Please take a moment to write this down.
Seek appropriate intervention or assistance. Again, keeping in mind the attorney-client confidentiality and the need for assistance, but releasing as little information or as narrowly tailored as possible in seeking that outside advice. Model rule 1.14, comment subsection 8 continued, says, when taking protective action pursuant to paragraph subsection B, the lawyer is impliedly authorized to make the necessary disclosures, even when the client directs the lawyer to the contrary. So again, you want to ascertain the limits of incapacity, how pertinent it is to the attorney-client privilege, what outside assistance you might need for the protection of the client or family members, if that's an issue, or the protection of you yourself as the attorney. Nevertheless, given the risks of disclosure in paragraph subsection C, it talks about what is limited that the lawyer may disclose in consulting with other individuals or entities or seeking the appointment of a legal representative. At the very least, the lawyer should determine whether it's likely the person or entity consulting with will act adversely the client's interests before discussing matters related to the client. So again, we want to make sure that we are acting within the ethical bounds and often the common sense bounds of dealing with somebody who is exhibiting the red flags we've discussed, who has questionable capacity as we've discussed, and figuring out what the balance is between getting in outside advice and consultation, limiting the amount of information we need to give out, all while maintaining that attorney-client confidentiality. Keep the ethical rules and guidance in mind as we consider the legal recourses available in what I've deemed to be the mental health legal toolkit. So what is in our mental health legal toolkit? And this is what we bring to bear when we have clients with questionable capacity or attorneys who reach out to us seeking advice on what to do with someone with diminished capacity or a particular case they're working on that may involve diminished capacity and so on. Well, one might be guardianship or conservatorship. And again, we have to act pursuant to our client's interests. So we have to tread lightly when we might be considering guardianship or conservatorship in deciding whether that really is necessary and appropriate in order to be able to offer the services that we as attorneys are offering or that they've come to us to request. We need to also, in our legal toolkit, consider the management of legal affairs. Do they have capacity or not to execute a healthcare proxy or a power of attorney or a living will? Do they understand that giving over some of that autonomy might be helpful to them, bringing in someone they trust in order to help make those decisions or make decisions on their behalf? Healthcare proxy laws, power of attorney laws, living will laws are all state specific. So we as attorneys want to be familiar with what under their state law is appropriate, what the criteria are, what the guidance is, and who can act as a surrogate or an agent pursuant to these types of statutes. We may want to consider case management services. We have mental health case managers in our practice who are specially trained to work with individuals and families who have mental health challenges and utilize them to try and engage with the individual, help them work through their issues, seek guidance on what to do next. My case managers also have a wealth of information regarding possible input from mental health professionals, whether it's individual therapists, mental health professionals such as psychologists or psychiatrists, programs across the country, residential facilities, and so on. What are some of the protective measures that we may need to bring to bear? And again, this is where that line between what are ethical obligations and our attorney-client privilege is balanced with the threat or risk of danger to self or others. We may need to consider orders of protection, either for our client or for other members of the client's circle. Extreme risk protection orders. These are more and more statutes that are passed in states regard to firearms and people who possess firearms and whether they have the ability or the safety to possess those firearms. We may want to consider a psychiatric intervention. And again, it depends on whether we're working with a family or an individual who has mental health challenges, who may lack insight, may not act in their own best interest, may have certain challenges that prevent them from acting in their best interest. So psychiatric interventions may be appropriate in bringing to bear a mental health professional, security details, case managers. I'm present at these as well in order to make sure there's legal entry and so on. An inpatient hospitalization might be required. Again, it's specific to state law and your individual state mental hygiene laws as to what the criteria is for involuntarily committing someone, keeping them in a facility, and treating them over their objection should they lack insight and be refusing medical or psychiatric treatment. We also may want to consider outpatient treatment, whether it's a partial hospitalization, assisted outpatient treatment order, which many more states have these days, and whether that might be a help in assisting a client in working with you as an attorney or assisting a family who's looking to get other assistance from professionals via court order, as opposed to just hoping for and asking the individual to participate on a voluntary basis. So specifically guardianship and conservatorship, let's break down all of the options that I've outlined. Well, we want to consider whether appointment of a guardian ad litem, separate and different from a conservator or court-appointed guardian, is necessary to protect the client's interests or assist the client in completing the legal transaction at issue. A guardianship or conservatorship is a legal proceeding by which a court appoints and oversees a legal decision maker for another adult who, due to their quote-unquote functional limitations, is unable to manage their own affairs. Usually, there are two separate sides to the guardianship statute. One is called personal needs or healthcare decision making, involving medical care, residential decisions, travel, and the other side is often financial or property management. Financial decisions, defend legal proceedings, apply for benefits, and so on. So it's very important to know what your state law is. Management of legal affairs, a healthcare proxy, for example, gives authority to an appointed agent to make certain medical decisions when the principal becomes unable to do so. A power of attorney, which allows the principal to appoint an agent or an attorney in fact to make enumerated financial decisions, either immediately or when the principal becomes unable to do so. A living will, which is an informed medical statement which allows an individual to set forth in detail their preferences for medical treatment, procedures, or end-of-life treatment. I'm not a fan of living wills in that sometimes the wording in living wills can be ambiguous or difficult to truly ascertain under specific circumstances. Having sat on hospital ethics committees for many years, we sometimes are challenged by what the individual really meant in terms of life-sustaining treatment or end-of-life decision-making. So we encourage our clients to complete healthcare proxies, making sure that they've discussed with the agent what their preferences and wishes are, and moving forward in that direction. But again, know what your state law is and know what the parameters of that state law would be. Case management. Case managers, as I've said, are trained to assess the individual's ability and needs. Working with the individual, they can assist with daily living skills and socialization. Case managers can coordinate benefits and services that are provided by state, local, and private agencies, federal agencies, and so on. But keep in mind, this requires the individual to accept those services. Anything outside of an involuntary hospital commitment has to be voluntary on the part of the individual. So that's where it becomes very challenging for us as attorneys working with these individuals or for families who want to offer assistance or help. It's very important to keep in mind what is involuntary, again, only in a hospital setting, versus voluntary, anything outside of that hospital setting. It's very important to know what your state laws are in this area. Orders of protection. Family courts or criminal courts can issue orders of protection. And again, know what your state law is specific to what the requirements are of obtaining an order of protection, how to bring about this type of proceeding, and so on. Generally, orders of protection come in two forms, and you can have one, the other, or both. One may be a removal or a stay away order. The person can't stay in the home, can't come within so many feet of a home or business. And the other is a refrain from, cannot stalk, harass, send threatening emails or texts, all of the social media posts that often become challenges for the individual and for the family members and so on. More and more states are also passing what are called ERPO law, or extreme risk protection orders. An ERPO order seeks to prohibit an individual from purchasing, possessing, or attempting to purchase or possess a firearm, rifle, or shotgun. And it's important to know what your state law is pursuant to these extreme risk protection orders. They're also referred to as red flag laws, yellow flag laws, and so on. We've talked about intervention, the players and the goals, inpatient hospitalization. Very important to know what the state law is, what the wording is. Danger in most states doesn't have to rise to the level of homicidal or suicidal. A person can often be a danger to themselves or others based on their individual signs and symptoms. Are they paranoid and might strike out at someone? And then are they unable to focus? So they walk in traffic or don't dress appropriately in the weather or don't have food or the ability to get the nourishment that they require. The ability to follow medical care or an inability to seek legal guidance as might be necessary to protect them. We see this often in landlord-tenant situations, matrimonial, trust and estates law. So again, very important to understand what your state law is regard to the option of ascertaining and receiving an inpatient involuntary commitment. We've talked about outpatient treatment options. And in fact, we've talked about other options that may not be pursuant to statute, but may be the common sense or the case management option. So in summary, mental illness can impact anyone at any time. As you move forward in your legal career, remember ABA, Model Rule 1.14, comment subsection 2. The fact that a client suffers a disability does not diminish the lawyer's obligation to treat the client with attention and respect. Very important to ascertain what their level of incapacity might be. How far does it extend? How subject specific is it? Whether you can maintain your representation of a particular client with regard to why they've come to you or why their family members or other loved ones may have come to you, and whether you can carry out your requirements as an attorney even in light of a challenged someone with a challenged capacity in order to achieve the goals for which the client has come to you. Keep in mind the red flags that we've talked about. Ascertain whether these impair your ability to provide services to your client or not. Seek outside guidance and advice if you're unsure or inexperienced in ascertaining these types of challenges. And seek the proper guidance. Again, as I said earlier, documentation of your records is critical in making sure that you are protected as a practicing attorney, that you're following the model rules, that you know what your state law is, that you have some understanding of capacity challenges and diminished capacity, and that you follow these as is appropriate. When in doubt, ask for assistance. You don't always have to reveal the specifics of a client, name, why they're there, and so on, but you can seek advice in a general way. I have a client who says XYZ. I have concerns about their capacity. I'm not sure I can truly offer the services to them based on their level of understanding. What do you think I should do? What would you do in these circumstances? Is there anyone else outside I can seek guidance from? Should I request an individual mental health evaluation? How do I approach the client in doing that or the family members who have come to me? All of these are questions that you want to ask and ascertain in trying to follow the model rules, the ethical rules, the legal obligations that you have in representing a client while at the same time providing them with the services for which they've come to seek guidance from you. I'd like to thank all of you for participating in this webinar today. Again, my name is Carolyn Reinach-Wolf. I'm an executive partner and director of our firm's mental health law practice at Abrams Fensterman. If you have any follow-up questions or concerns or want clarification, please feel free to reach out to me at cwolf, C-W-O-L-F, at abramslaw.com. And my office number is 516-592-5857. I'm always happy to answer emails, phone calls, and consult on cases that have mental health implications, capacity determinations or decisions, and so on. So again, thank you for participating today. And I'm happy to hear from you should you have any follow-up questions or concerns. Thank you.